started. Welcome to the November 21st Faith Committee meeting. We'll start out, we have a new member. As you know, Steve DeLong had to depart the committee, and I nominated a new member. Go ahead and tell everybody about your background.
Michael Luckman, Mayor of Property. I've been with the mayor for 32 years. I moved to Virginia 15 years ago to open an office down here. I'm the regional director down here for mayor, and luckily we've done well. We have 27 buildings here in Loudoun, and we hope to have some more. So I look forward to working with y'all here.
Great. For Mike's sake, let's just pop around the room real quick, everybody. Let's just start everybody. Let's start with you, Joe.
Okay, I'm Jill Caneth, and I'm with the planning department, and I'm the demographer. And so I do many of the residential and corporate data sets that you see on this committee.
Beth? Beth Hulkemeyer, research manager and management financial services. So we've got a few different things that this committee does, but I'm the project manager for the guidelines.
Jim Bowman, during the day. John Marshall Banks, senior vice president there, and I represent the Blue Ridge District.
I see you in all the ads. You and Paul.
That's right.
Paul and I are old friends. He was chairman of the chamber.
Yes.
2 years before I was chairman.
Yep.
So that's how I got to know him so well.
Good.
So yeah.
Okay. Mike Kruger, retired, live in Loudoun County, owns some property, live in Ashby Ponds, retirement community.
I'm Lisa Erickson. I work with county administration, but I'm one of the many recording clerks for board of supervisors.
Great.
John Bischoff, also retired, IBM and AOL. Teach part-time at George Washington University and generally annoy Ralph.
Okay, Hobie.
Wannabe.
He's a Hobie wannabe.
Yeah, I've been called Mini Hobie.
Mini Hobie.
Fred Morrison, senior software developer at C-Focus Software. I've lived in Loudoun County since January of 89 and was nominated by Suzanne Volpe to be on this committee.
Sam?
Sam Adamo, Director of Planning and Legislative Services for Loudoun County Public Schools.
And Mike, for your knowledge, this is Dory. Dory's my senior aide, so if you have issues or need help or just need anything, call Dory. She's the best problem solver I know, so some of the constituent issues she solves, I don't know how she does it, so it's very good.
And by the way, I do live in Loudoun County.
Oh, good. Where do you live?
I live out in Taylorstown.
Taylorstown, okay.
Yeah.
You're in...
right outside Lovettsville.
Yeah, you're in... you're in Gary's district.
Yeah.
You're in Gary's district, yeah. Okay, good.
I live off Taylorstown Road.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Actually, more rural than I am.
Yeah.
I'm not from Lovettsville.
Yeah.
And
Mike, for your knowledge, I'm the Ashburn District Supervisor, and the reason I sit on this committee... I'm chairman of the board's Finance, Government Services, and Operations Committee. And with that means you chair the Fiscal Impact Committee, you sit on the other Post-Employment Benefit Board of Trustees, you sit on the LOSAP Board of Trustees, there's all these other things that come with it. I also co-chair the Board of Supervisors Joint Committee with the School Board. So keep busy. Let me start out with a little bit of administrative. As you know, we've had some quorum problems this fall that we didn't have last spring. And so Dory put together a list of everybody on the committee and basically everybody's attendance records and who made that nomination appointment. And I put that out to the full board and said, guys, I need your help. We need to get quorum. You ever want me to get this to the full board? Dory personally called four of the Fiscal Impact Committee members who have missed all three meetings this fall so far. Two just neglected us to tell us they weren't going to be able to serve anymore, two of the four. After one, we couldn't even find a phone number. Some board members have been helpful. One has been just the opposite, but I'll work through that. So. What I'm planning on doing then is rather than us, if I don't have a quorum, we can't make official motions and vote. And I don't count for quorum and I don't get a vote. So we're one shy tonight. for a quorum. We need one more. So what my plan to do is we are going to take straw votes or unofficial votes here tonight. And if I never reach a quorum, I'm just going to take it to the full board anyhow. Tell the full board, I've still had problems with quorum. We're going to make some changes to the fiscal impact committee. However, in order to get this to the full board, I'm bringing it with straw votes only. I will brief the board on those straw votes, and I will give my recommendations to the full board, and we'll take our action accordingly, and we'll vote. So if we don't have a quorum to take official votes, we're going to take unofficial votes, and I'm still going to carry it to the full board. There's no reason we can't do that. I discussed it with Chairman York. He's comfortable with that approach. So I'm going to go ahead with unofficial votes tonight anyhow.
Can I add one suggestion?
Yeah, sure.
When we do have a quorum,
we could reaffirm those.
You just reaffirm them, but
yes,
you don't. I mean, because obviously, if everybody here has voted unanimously, the reaffirm is going to be
no.
At best, 6-1.
And that was my plan.
Yeah.
If we
so
have,
we
two,
have, to go
we have two more meetings left this fall, right?
Yep.
We had to cancel. We're going back to back. I think it's the 12th and the 19th.
Yes. Right. The 19th is if you need it.
If we need it, okay. And the reason we did that is we had a full board meeting. A board of supervisors meeting that got in the way of one of our every other meetings. So if we only have one left, that means we'd have to get the quorum next time and we'll reaffirm the motions.
Okay. I know I'm not going to be out on the 19th either.
I don't want to be here on the 19th either. And we've actually canceled our second full board business meeting in December because it's getting near Christmas. So none of us want to be here, Mike.
I'll be out the 12th. I'll
be out the 12th, okay.
Yeah,
okay, well, we'll see what we can do then. At least you can get your feet wet tonight. So, from Mike's knowledge, we've already covered the commercial real estate a couple weeks ago. So it would have been great if we could have gotten you on by then, but I had to wait till the next board business meeting to nominate you, and I even suspended the rules to turn your nomination into an appointment that night. But I couldn't move it till we had the regular meeting. If I could have done it a couple weeks earlier, then we could have got you on when we covered commercial. But we'll be meeting again in the spring, and we'll revisit a lot of that. So
I did listen to the meeting.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I kind of.
It's like watching paint dry.
Yeah. I love that.
It's like our board meetings. I swear, my wife only turns on the TV to know when to kick her boyfriend out because I'm coming home to meetings. So. I'll get on and she'll go, what were you guys talking about? I didn't understand any of it. I said, neither did I, don't worry. All right. Where we were going to start tonight, if you remember in the last meeting, we went through the residential tables, the A4, the A5, A and B, the A6, A, B, and C. You received some slightly revised ones that came out yesterday, I think it was, the day before, one of the two.
Tuesday evening.
Thank you. My days are blurring. I got to do something fun before I came here for meetings this afternoon. We actually cut the ribbon on United Airlines' new wide-body maintenance hangar this afternoon. And so myself, the chairman and CEO of United, Supervisor Letourneau, Delegate Greeson, they parked a 777 right in front of it, put the ribbon right there, opened the big doors, and cut a ribbon. So it's kind of cool.
But you're not at the party down at the Hazy.
Well, this is more fun.
No, this is with the donors who give more than six figures.
Yeah, I realize that. Oh. So it only takes six figures to run for supervisor.
Where's that thing? What part of the airport are they going to build that at?
If you're going down Autopilot Drive where the rental car returns are,
yeah,
and you keep going and eventually it ends at a stop sign and you have all the Washington Flyer taxis on your left, and if you went right, you can go the back way out of the airport.
Yeah. Yep.
Just before that stop sign on your left, right back there.
Okay.
And they can put two full wide bodies inside the hangar.
Cool.
Two, not one.
Wow.
So you can have two 777s in there side by side. So it's very impressive what they're doing. And it was a many, many million dollar investment. But anyhow, that's not why we're here tonight.
All right. 777 adventure.
Oh,
the airport?
That was airport? The Dreamlifter. That's a modified 747.
Oh, okay.
What that's about is, I've got a picture of it I can show you on my iPad.
Well,
but what that's about is Boeing, you know, they're building the 787. And I'm a former Air Force pilot, so I follow this stuff. And the parts of the 787 are built in big sub-assemblies around the world. And like the nose units are built near Wichita, for example, the entire front of the fuselage for the nose. They use these modified 747s to go pick up all these parts and get them back to the two prime assembly plants in Seattle and Charleston. And they were going to Wichita, and they were supposed to land at McConnell Air Force Base, and they were 8 miles off. And they landed on a 6,100-foot runway with a 747. That's too short.
Okay. I heard 9,000 was what they need to take
They
off.
Need, realistically, 9,000. So they did get the plane stopped. They had to manually turn it around with one of the tugs. And then they spent a day doing calculations to figure out whether they had enough runway to get it off the ground. And they kept taking weight off the plane.
Yep.
They took weight off the plane, and eventually they got it where they felt the calculations were right, and they got it out okay. So it is out of there now. That's a real oops. Sorry.
Missed it by that much.
8 miles. Yeah.
Did you hear the tape between the tower and the pilot?
No.
Where the tower asked the pilot, "Do you know which airport you're at?" And the pilot basically blew him off.
Really?
Well, yeah. Cocky little answer back, "We know what we're doing."
Okay.
Sounds like he's in the NFL now, as a not for long employee.
All right. Is there anything you want to tell us or refresh us on the residential tables?
The table that was revised was A2, and that's one that just is history. So that's one that does not require a quorum.
Right.
So anything that we discussed last week with the group that required a quorum, everybody was pretty much in favor of and supportive of, and so we were asked to bring back the motions today for those tables, but we, as Supervisor Buono said, we don't have a quorum, so we could only take a straw vote on those. Would any of you like me, if you weren't here last week, want us to briefly walk you through?
No.
No. Or should we just go to the straw votes?
Yes.
Okay. Sam's stuff's more fun. I want to get to that.
I want to get it.
We have a lot to discuss with the student generation.
All right.
Do we have to make a motion to take a straw vote to unanimously accept the motions? The three motions.
There's actually four motions to be made.
Yeah.
Let me ask this. Is there anybody that thinks they might oppose any of these four motions? All right, then it could be made as one big motion. I can't make the motion, here's how I would make it. I would make the first one, I move that the Fiscal Impact Committee approve forecast building permits through blah, 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 and I further move, and you make the second one, and I further move, and you make the third one, and I further move, and you make the fourth one. Then we can take one vote.
Okay, I replicate that request.
So moved.
Somebody seconded.
Actually, somebody, just because we're recording,
I think we actually have to
record,
say
it. Somebody go ahead and actually read the entire motion, and whoever wants to.
You start?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I don't have it.
Who has reading glasses?
I have it in front of me.
Go ahead, Fred.
All right. The first motion is I move that the Fiscal Impact Committee approve the forecast of building permits through 2040 as shown in Table A4. And I further move that the Fiscal Impact Committee approve the vacancy rates by unit type as shown in Table A5A. And I further move that the Fiscal Impact Committee approve household sizes by unit types as shown in Table A5B. And I further move that the Fiscal Impact Committee approve the forecast of new units by planning subarea through 2040 as shown in Table A6, Sections A, B, and C.
Do I hear a second? Seconded by Mr. Krueger.
Krueger.
Now, if I wanted to be really a jerk, I could say, does anybody want to divide the motion? But we won't. Since y'all made it together. All right, any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, that motion carries 6-0. 7. Is 13 or 14?
13.
6-0 with 7 absent. Yes, you have the list. Okay, thank you, guys. All right, let's move on to the second item of business. Public schools, student generation factors. Welcome, Sam.
Hey, Sam.
Oh,
I would like to give a little preamble that relates to the residential table somewhat, and then as we move into looking at this. Last week, one of the things in your motion was household sizes.
Yep.
And then this week, we're looking at people generation rates. So I think everybody can agree that within a given household, there are children, which is where the people generation rates come in. Both of those components are important when the committee next year starts looking at the capital intensity factor.
Right.
So the way that's structured is there's a county facility cost side, which uses the household size factors to say how many people per unit type. And then there's a school cost portion that uses the pupil generation rates by these different housing unit types. So we used to have single family detached, attached, and multifamily. This year, based on feedback and analysis, staff has brought forward a couple of different options for multifamily. You'll have those to use if you want to differentiate between multifamily attached and multifamily stacked when you go to develop the capital intensity factor. With the single family detached, staff this year also did a differentiation based on planning sub-areas, so our more rural planning sub-areas versus the remainder or our suburban and Route 7 West planning sub-areas. Those you don't have to differentiate in the capital intensity factor. You can keep just a single family detached set of rates for those. So I just wanted to give you that sense of that. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But otherwise, we can move into
The Holy Grail, this goes way back to our first meeting last spring, but the Holy Grail is kind of the capital intensity factor. That's where we're trying to get to. And if you would, Beth, or even Julie, refresh the committee and what might be new as to what the capital intensity factor is and what we use it for.
Okay, so I think you have... So you can jump in if you want, but basically they're used as guidelines for proffers. So proffers are something that the development community is requested to provide in the context of a rezoning. So Julie Pastor's here, our planning director, so she leads all the staff that process those rezonings among other activities that the planning department does. So it's a way for us to say through the capital, or for the county to say through the capital intensity factors, these are the capital facilities we think we should be providing and are planning to provide in the future. Here's what they cost, and then here's how you relate those to either the total number of people, which is for the county facilities, or the total number of school kids, which is that school's portion of capital intensity.
Okay, great. Any questions for...
One thing I would just say is we only apply the capital intensity factor through residential rezonings.
Right.
So it is not used during that piece of it. I mean, there are proffers that relate to commercial development. Don't get me started down that path. But for the capital facilities component, it is only related to new residential development. That's
even
cool. It only goes through a legislative process. We don't have impact fees in the state of Virginia yet for these kinds of things. But Loudoun is one of the unique jurisdictions. The guidelines that we use, it creates a level playing field so that the development community knows going in when they are come before the Board of Supervisors that this is the expectation for how their new development, generating new people, not the, by right, this is new people, how that's going to impact us. So they are very interested in this number because, again, it creates that level playing field to when they come in. Now, the board always has the discretion for what they give them credit for, but we try to keep it to a formula so that it is very clear what is in the formula, so that then if the board gives them credit against something, that's fine, but we very rarely don't get the number. The number is the number. How they give them credit, that's something else, but the idea is that we have that out there.
But credit is still against the number that this formula generates.
That's correct.
So it is a level setting type of formula.
That's correct.
And it includes even residential when it's a part of a mixed-use development. There could be commercial with residential components, and it does apply to that residential piece.
Because the formula is based on those unit types and the household sizes,
right,
and the pupils per household. That's how the formula is generated.
Right.
So if you have a piece of by right land, say in the western part of the county, you pay nothing.
The county is basically saying the base level of development is on us. Right. We're saying this is what we want. We are able to pay, have to pay, because that's the base level that we accept. And this has kept us out of jail in a sense that,
right,
you know, we have to have a nexus when we do things. But if a developer comes in and asks for something beyond that base, then we're saying, wait a minute, we expect you to contribute to making us whole. And you know, those services that new population is going to generate, we're not responsible for that. That's on you.
Well, let me rephrase that. it helps us with the capital side of things.
Oh, right.
It does not help us with the operating budget side of things.
Major detail. We only deal with the capital side.
Correct. That's why it's the capital intensity factor.
That's correct. Yes. Sorry about that.
Correct. So you're right. You're right. Also, if I can just kind of clarify for the committee, we have two items left tonight: public school student generation, and then we have the county side of the pupil generation rate analysis. And you're going to see that the school's numbers are a little different than the county's numbers, not by a big amount, but some, because the formulas are a little different. In other words, the county accounts for all kids in a home, whether they're in public schools or they're in private schools. There's these kinds of differences. So from the committee standpoint tonight, are you looking for a motion on item 3 to affirm or not affirm those pupil generation rates, and no motion on item 2? Okay, I just wanted to kind of play straight man so that everybody understood where we were going with this tonight.
Why wouldn't they do the calculations the same?
That's what we will describe.
We're going to go through
lots
that.
Of
okay,
we'll
have to find out.
Lots of detail on that.
Straight.
But it's a really good question. We'll go through that. So,
everybody
Sam,
gets
started
through that model.
Sure. And let's remember, the schools are worried about building schools. The county has to build sheriff stations and parks and roads and all these other things, too, that the schools don't necessarily account for in their capital budget.
Libraries.
Sure.
Kids have to go to, whether they're homeschooled or public school.
That's right. And that's part of the reason. So, yeah.
Or private school.
But a key part of the discussion is how different really are they and what's the effect?
From an operating budget standpoint, we know the effect very well. Okay, Sam.
Thank you, Mr. Bona. Again, I'm just going to try to walk you through this and provide some historical perspective on Loudoun County Public Schools, our student generation rates, where they come from, and again, how we take a look at some of this information. The first page that I provided you, I think, gives you a pretty good feel in looking at this from a historical perspective. We've actually provided you information going back to our 1986 triennial census up to our last triennial census, which was in 2008. In 2010 or 2011, the assembly changed the calculation and let the University of Virginia begin providing information to us. Again, we were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars. What happened here in Loudoun is that every time the triennial census would roll around, rather than estimating students and counts throughout the county, what we actually did is something similar to what the Census Bureau does, and we hired enumerators. Basically, they did not get minimum wage. They had a base rate. I think we started them at something like $1.50. But for every kid they would count, there was an incremental change. And so depending on the house that an enumerator visited, we had some that
I had a gold mine. There were 7 kids here. And so you start looking at that, and I think we started initially at 75 cents, and as times changed, they actually went up to $1.25. And you would think, oh, if somebody hit the gold mine and they would get a $10 or a $12 house, that was really good. But when you looked at what we would expend on the census, which near the end was around $400,000 or $500,000 versus the money that we were getting from the state, it was something worthwhile. But again, as you began looking at the man hours, the months that were involved, I mean, we would actually start canvassing people before we turn them loose. I mean, we would start a training session with these people in November, get them out on the streets by March, April, and May, then get them back, get their numbers, and we would cross-tabulate this and then report the census. It got to be very time-consuming. So again, looking at it from a more global perspective seemed to make sense. But I think one of the real important things, and I think that's a link to what we're doing today, is looking at, and again, what we're trying to do is take the best estimate that we can. And so we do look at all housing that's out there. And I think there's some caveats that, you know, we look at, especially from a school perspective, that do create some changes, I guess, or, you know, things that we look at. For example, when you begin to look at the one, I guess, sort of up close and personal example that we provided you on page 2, this is a snapshot of Brambleton. If anybody has ever driven through there, what you're looking at is the area immediately south of Briarwood High School on the east and west side of Belmont Ridge Road. And just to give you a little perspective, when that area started, and again, it's very, very recent, it was 05, we only had about 300 kids coming out of that area. And if you begin looking at the numbers that we're counting today, a few short years later, those two planning zones, again, it was one area and had a little over 300 kids. Now we're looking at 1,196 students coming from the single-family detached units and an additional 334 from the single-family attached. And so, again, if you start to look at that, you'll start to see that, yeah, you know what, there is a relationship between the age of the housing stock and the units. And I think one of the things that is we try to take into perspective, not every unit in Loudoun County. I mean, we have a lot of people who are moving in here, they're coming here, they're in their prime childbearing years, but necessarily, you know, what we have seen is that as subdivisions are new, that's their greatest rate of student generation. After that, and they mature, what you start to see is that those subdivisions and the counts in the units tend to subside, and they do tend to generate far fewer students once they're mature. I think another important factor that we tend to look at is also housing affordability. I think one of the things, if you would, for example, look at some of the data that the county's going to share with you, it's all pretty much new housing stuff. And so I'm going to say, well, if we want to focus on that, I guess what we're thinking is that provides somewhat of a skewed perspective of the kids that you're going to get. Because it's newer, you're going to get somewhat higher student generation factors. However, you know, if you look at some of our older subdivisions, and I'll use Countryside, you know, we've had some tremendous change there. At 2000, they were up there generating students like the rest of the county. But if you look at that, they have fallen from about a 0.82 down to under 0.5 for their single family detached. So I think that age makes a difference. I think the other important thing is that we look at is also housing affordability. Because if you would apply that same standard and take a look at what's happening, for example, in Sterling Park, that is an area that is rich and fertile as some of our new subdivisions, yet right now, if we're looking at that from a school planning perspective, what we're worried about is as we look at the kids that are in the pipeline, if you were to look at everything that's in there, that's approved, whether they be multifamily, some of the single family attached mixes, I mean, and if boundaries don't change, you know, you're probably looking at the need of changing Sterling Park from a middle school that serves 1,184 to expanding it to a middle school that needs 1,350 kids for its same service area. And again, we're looking at the kids that are in the pipeline, how many are there, and again, there's a direct relationship to housing affordability, and we think that's a pretty important thing that you can't look at. Same thing is true for Parkview High School. If you start looking at those kids that are in the pipeline, and then you add the our current liability of everything that's approved, and if it comes to fruition, you're going to be in the way of seats, you need to be looking at a Parkview High School that's going to be capable of accommodating not 1,600 students, but 1,800. And when you look at some of these older areas, one of the things that, you know, we have to answer, do we have room to move these kids elsewhere? I don't think at the elementary level that's as critical, but when you begin looking at the high school enrollments and our middle school enrollments, you know, moving kids from one space to another is more problematic because there's no additional space anywhere north or south of Route 7, let alone looking to the east. And so, you know, we tend to take a good look at these things and how they might affect us. And again, and a building addition isn't simply we're going to slap, you know, 10 rooms on here and increase your capacity. According to some of the new building codes that you're probably familiar with, if you're retrofitting older facilities, you've got to make them comparable and equivalent. And so a lot of times, if you get to a certain threshold square footage, what you end up doing is having to sprinkle a building or make, you know, fairly significant changes to your HVAC, your service loads and things like that. And so that has a way of escalating the cost of any potential addition. So these are some of the things that we tend to look at as we go through and do our analyses of, you know, the housing, what's there, what we're seeing, and we try to track that over time. And so, you know, one of the things I think if you look at some of these triennial censuses over time, this does include a count of all of the kids in the county. Now again, we had many a numerator for war stories that would go up, knock on a door, and people would say, no, you're not coming in here, get off of my property or I'll shoot you kind of thing, or, oh yeah, none of our kids are in school, we're homeschooling them, and you know, we've got 8 kids here. And so we know we were probably somewhere around the 98% range when we were counting houses back then. And so we had a fairly high reliability. But again, if you look at the kids that we were serving at private school plus the home school, you know, we've always had very, very stable rates when it came to that as far as our private school population and our home school population. It's always been usually 7 to 8%, and you know, we've had some fluctuations in and around 8 or 9, but that would be the outside. So even if you were to take, in our opinion, the public school population, and they've increased that by 10%. That should give you a pretty good idea of where you stand as far as your overall school population. So again, when you look at what we're doing right now with our current reporting, and we're doing this on an annual basis, we are taking into account all of the units that we're finding in the county. We take our public school enrollment and then we do calculations based upon the number of units. And I think one of the things that we have done, and as we began looking at it, again, you can take smaller samples and you can say, well, I'm getting X student generation from this, or you can take it more holistically. What we found to be the biggest difference in our student generation rates were really, it was density. And density was related to utilities, central utilities having water and sewer. And if you look at the map that we provided on the last part of the presentation, what you begin to see is that we have a vast swath of the county that probably is 55, maybe 60% of the total county's area that is not served with central utilities, and we don't see that really being changed. At some point in the future, Western Loudoun may end up looking like Western Fairfax. There was a time when, probably 30 years ago, when there were people around the table in Fairfax County kind of looking around saying, it's going to be nothing but farms out there, and we have now seen what Western Fairfax looks like. what we're trying to do is provide you the world as we see it today. And again, if we were looking at the introduction of central utilities to that area, we'd probably have a very, very different need and calculation as far as our future school sites were concerned. And I think one of the things, as we begin looking out and you start averaging this together, it creates a good mix between some of our older developments and our newer developments. And I think, yes, we do get lower figures, but that also acts as a break so that we aren't looking at, for example, a worst case and calculating facilities that may ultimately not be needed. So again, I think using a somewhat lower student generation factor from the perspective of the schools has served us well.
Sam, if I can ask a question on that. You know, we've had to deal with this recently as a board. You've come and briefed us on this. And it's true, utilities bring development. Development means we have to go acquire land for schools. Okay? That, I think everybody understands that. But Supervisor Higgins asked me the question, well, forget that for a minute. Why are there just significantly fewer kids in homes that are on wells and septic, for example, or communal systems, versus homes that are on public utilities?
The water.
It's the water.
Well, I think, and, you know, and, there's a combination.
I gave him my view of it, but I'd like to hear the school's view of it. But he was very curious. He said, you know, because he represents the Catoctin
district.
I
know that. And
he said, you know, I got homes with tons of kids out here. I don't get it. Now, he was trying to justify a higher number because he wants a site for a school. But at the same time, why is there that difference?
I think there's a relationship between, again, the age of the housing stock that you're looking at. There's been a lot of Western Loudoun that it is much older. And again, because you have larger homes on larger lots, you don't have that same kind of density that you see in the suburban areas. And, you know, we can find pockets, for example, in Western Loudoun, some of our recent by-right subdivisions out there, the old A3 stuff that developed after 2000. We'll take a look at that and we'll see that there are student generation. If you look at that student generation factor on one little part, it'll be over one. However, if you look at a broader swath, for example, some of the land that we looked at north of 287 for potential school sites, I mean, what you start to see...
I don't think that was the question, though. Because you said, you know, the density, and I can understand the density because you need well and septic. And,
right.
But if I have a house and it gets Board of Health approval for 4 bedrooms because I have enough water and I have enough sewer, why does that house only generate 0.57 children per house when the one in Leesburg generates 1.2? And I think that's the question.
But we're not seeing that in Leesburg again.
Well, I mean, it's there,
no, but
wherever.
It's more of a high level question. It's not about the location in the county. It's about why does take a single family detached home, why does it generate fewer kids if it's on a well and septic versus if it's on a public utility? That's the core of the question that Supervisor Higgins
is asking. And it's not the density of the entire area. It's the density of that house.
I think I understand what you're saying.
No,
the development I live in is Taylorstown Meadows.
Okay.
We have 32 houses. We have 37 kids. The development was built 11 years ago. So we have a lot of young families in there that have a lot of kids. You can go up, you know, probably they don't, I don't even know, you know, what another development, an older development, probably over on the behind the game club, I bet they don't have 10 kids in that whole development, and it's they have more houses.
Yeah, but then the differentiator is not on the utilities. The differentiator is on the age of the house. And
it's the age of the house, I think.
Yeah,
there are other things that are going on here. I mean, right now, I mean, population comes in waves, and right now we are on the tail end of a wave. If you look at the baby boom generation as their birth tapered off. In 1978, there was an uptick. And in 84, it was no big surprise that school enrollment started to go up. And again, that's because the earliest baby boomers started having their families and their children. And originally, demographers were saying that in and around 2000, we're going to have our peak and they're going to go down again. What changed that? It was the amount of immigration that we had in this country, and it sustained birth rates throughout the country. In 2000, when we had the experience of the great economic unpleasantries, all of a sudden we had one of the greatest declines infertility and birth rates that the United States has seen since the crash of 1929. So there are ebbs and flows to this, and so what you're looking at is the age of the housing, it's when you're seeing these people come. And one of the things that has insulated Virginia from looking, or Northern Virginia, looking like the rest of the country has simply been the fact that we have a lot of employment here. Employment tends to attract younger people who are in their prime childbearing years, and so we are receiving a disproportionate share of them. But it does not mean that we are going to be exempt from every of these major demographic trends. If you look at the enrollment projections that we just published, you're going to see that we are actually projecting declines in enrollment at the elementary level. But they're going to be going down.
And I'll agree with everything you're saying, absolutely. But again, because now I'm curious, okay, if I take a house that was built in 1980, in Sterling, with four bedrooms, and I take a house that was built out past Round Hill, whatever past Round Hill, Bluemont, out there somewhere, and it was built in 1980 with four bedrooms. The fact that one is on town water and sewer and one is not should have no difference in the amount of children that it puts in the school district.
I think there.
Or should it?
You're talking about a lot of different things. I mean,
no, I'm talking about take two houses that are.
I know.
You keep saying, no, it's the age of the house. It's, you know, the baby boom.
Well, the age of the house is a valid fact.
But make them the same age. And just, you know.
Okay, but the question that you have is the likelihood when we look at Western Loudoun is that you don't have the same kind of turnover that you would in a Sterling Park. You don't have easy access to roads, to transportation networks and things like that. And a lot of people that need those kind of services are going to be in a more urban or suburban area. They aren't going to be out in Western Loudoun.
That's okay. I just don't see what the utility service area has to do with generating kids. Honestly,
growth.
Everything you're saying, all the reasons you're giving are different reasons.
I wasn't really questioning whether utilities are without was the issue. What I was questioning is, why are the numbers different? That's really the question.
And it's not, but I think what we're hearing a whole bunch of various reasons. But whether or not they have town water and sewer really isn't one of them.
I took it to mean that town water and sewer means where's your growth going to come in the future? If there is no water and sewer, you're not going to have as much growth.
Yeah, that's
we're also
issue.
Talking about the regeneration and the recycling of the houses and, you know, how Sterling Park has changed. It was very low, and then now it's going up as the houses are being resold. So I just don't see the utility service.
I think this point's well taken, though. I mean, the age of the house does factor in. And that you have a lot of newer homes in the east. Those newer homes are generating students. In the west, the housing inventory is extremely small compared to the east, extremely. Because that, and that inventory is older, so people that are coming that are childbearing years aren't necessarily looking to go out past the Round Hill, whatever's past the Round Hill. But they're looking to come.
It's not your district.
No, it's not my district. Once you cross Coos Creek, you've left mine. So, but I think the issue is the age of it. That people in childbearing years aren't moving out there. They're moving in the east where the amenities are. They're younger people, childbearing years. I think that is a part of it. And I think the turnover is a part. I think in the east, homes turn over, and now you get another family that could be a childbearing years. In the west, these are homesteads in many cases. People are there forever.
They don't turn over the same way. Take a look. Percentage-wise, the west may not be that far off in new construction than the east. Because it started from a much lower base, especially over like the past 5 years.
There's very little development.
No, but there's single houses. What do you do with a place? I think like what's the one up 50? I don't know. Raspberry Falls.
They're on.
Where the builder puts in their own system.
They're on communal.
Yeah.
Right.
How does that rate in here?
That's
they're not on a town system, but they're on a communal system.
I know, and they have lower student generations. I mean, we could pull the subdivision information out for you, but I mean, when you look at the totality overall, you have a lot fewer kids coming out of those areas. And again, part of it is you just don't have the same mass of houses. You aren't going to have that same turnover that you would in the east. And I think, you know, even if you look at some of our older neighborhoods in the east, for example, a countryside, or some of the older neighborhoods in Leesburg. Those are older neighborhoods, and yes, they're turning over, but we aren't seeing new demand for seats in those particular areas because the regeneration, yeah, a house might sell, but it's one in maybe 30 and you're going to have kids. But are you getting to the point where you're needing an expansion of that? No. I mean, it's you have reached an equilibrium.
Well, I agree with everything you're saying. I just, you know, when Ralph brought this up, I'm just like, yeah, I don't understand what utility service has to do with it, but we can move on.
Yeah. But again, I mean, that's how it seems to help provide us a better balance as we're projecting the need for new facilities.
When you did when the census was happening, it did not account for utilities or not utilities, correct?
No.
Right.
I mean,
so we don't technology. Have data to go back to verify against from when the census was occurring. We couldn't prove it one way or the other.
We probably could regenerate some of that.
Well, you probably could from an old census, yeah.
Yeah, from the old stuff and try to backdate and backfill.
I'm not trying to make work for you, but it's an interesting question when Gary asked me. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of thinking about it.
I mean, part of the issue that you have out west is that unless there's going to be some kind of the introduction of utilities that would change the densities of what we're anticipating out there, you have a limited amount of land that's available for development. And, I mean, we've done calculations. We looked at everything that has been approved, everything that's pending, everything that's been denied.
Right.
And if you would look at all of that, we would still have enough seats to accommodate all that new growth because...
You know, I agree. You got to plan based on what the laws are today. And, you know, if somebody comes in with a big rezoning and says, we're going to put in all the utilities...
They do a very good job. I was in the school building yesterday because I was there for the consultant that's interviewing people for the new superintendent, the new search, and I was there to be interviewed by them. And I went out in the lobby because they weren't ready for me yet. You had an entire map of my election district up in the lobby, showing all the approved development by the developer, all the planned development, all the stable development, all the active applications. I mean, it was laid out perfectly. And I stared at it for 5 minutes ago. I get everything in my district as far as what was approved, what's there, what's coming. And based on that, they can project the students based on our numbers. Right, right.
And you were lucky it was GIS day. So.
It was, that's why it's exactly what it was. I was lucky because you could have hit one of the other eight districts and you hit mine. So I was like, wow, look at this.
Right. But again, we do that part and parcel. I mean, every time that an application's going in, I mean, we're aware now that there's a lot of development activity and we even get all the rumors, who's doing what, or we get a call from developers saying, well, if we do X, what are you guys going to be looking for? And so we have a pretty good handle on even things that are coming down the pipeline and how we might have to alter our numbers.
Of course, if we consider broadband now a utility, there was a big move to bring that all to Western Loudoun.
Yes,
ain't gonna
that's
happen.
Utility number one.
I from personal interest, living outside of Lovettsville and Nowheresville, it'd be really a nice thought, but there's not enough people out there to make it worthwhile.
Let me try and net out the last 15 minutes.
Yes, let's do
that. Your initial question of why the West End is different than the East End, if I net it out just in my mind to simplify, age, point one. Two, there's more churn in the East Side, and churn brings more kids in more quickly. So you have more stability in the West, it's older aged, with the demographic maturity level going out. In the East, with the centralized services, is more prone to having a faster churn. And that's it.
It's a lot more desirable place to be.
I think it's affordability too.
My
house is a lot cheaper.
Affordability is a backfire there because affordability means younger people that are going to have kids are going to move there. And don't think things in the West are inexpensive.
No,
it's less expensive.
You can afford to buy the house.
I don't think you want to step on the topic about income level and economics relating to the number of children. You don't want to go there.
I think if you get to the last page of what you have to talk about, and again, these are what we looked at for 2013 and we shared with the school board. But when you start looking at the area with utilities, we had a 5/10 of a decline in the single family detached student generation. Our single-family ATAS is actually Now at 0.51 in the multifamily of 0.28. So what, you know, we're starting to see, and again, this requires us to monitor this, is that some of the big single family detached right now, and again, getting into the whole affordability thing, we're starting to see that it's easier for younger families to move into a single family attached unit. And, you know, I think there's some things that we have to look at. I mean, it's...
Do you see any big change in Millburg?
Well, it's... No.
Okay.
If anything, what we're seeing, I mean, there are actually fewer kids. I mean, the kids that are there don't necessarily go to school in Millburg.
Right.
I mean, they go elsewhere, so...
I was just curious.
No, we aren't seeing anything out there. If anything, you know, I mean, we're seeing... some of the transfer policies that the school board has instituted has actually helped some of the schools, like Lincoln. So they're actually getting people from Percival and even from in and around Route 7 Quarter going down there because they want a small school.
Well, the whole Waterford-Percival thing, that's a canker sore. So.
But anyway, I mean, there's just some things I think that we need to start looking at and trying to monitor on a longer basis. It's going to be some of the changes in the single-family attached and multifamily. We've seen our multifamily bump up. And again, we think that we're looking at some affordability issues here. Again, if you look at the price of the single-family detached house, you know, if you're a young professional moving in here, you're still looking at, you know, $500,000 or $600,000, and that's a pretty healthy chunk to bite off. So, again, these are things that we're looking at. Again, you know, we do count all of the housing stock as we're looking at this, and provide our, you know, our estimates based on those numbers.
Well, thanks, Sam. There's one question I have, and then what's going to be interesting is, because you do with utilities and without utilities, the county's numbers do not do that, correct?
Our numbers do the rural versus suburban using planning sub-areas.
True, so it's kind of a way to do it.
Because
at the end, when you sent out your things 2 days ago, and we already had the schools, I tried to do an apples to apples. How do our numbers look at theirs? It's not a perfect science to do it, and I think that's where we would want to wrap this up a little bit and when we get through you, Joe. But Sam, my question to you, so we can move on to the last item, is there was one thing that was a little surprising to me for your 2013 numbers, and that's under the single family attached, where without utilities is 0.64 and with utilities is 0.51. It's like it's backwards. Now, and I don't know, is there, maybe there's certain developments driving that. What do you know why?
Well, you know, again, I think it's going to take a little time to look at that. I mean, when you start looking at where we were at.
These two numbers right there.
You're saying.
Right.
Well, again, I think part of that, it's just skewed. It's an extremely small sample between
the
two.
That's what I was wondering.
And so. 1 versus 17,000.
I don't think you could really say that it's going to be higher in the West because we have such a little sample.
Your N is too small on the without utilities.
I mean, it doesn't really
mean anything.
You're right. The multifamily on the end, there's 5 students.
Yeah, I think what's going to be more interesting.
There's not much multifamily out west.
Yeah,
but they're
is
very
seeing
well
how that changes in our more densely in the area with utilities, because if that number continues to go up over time, and we start seeing more kids coming out of our multifamily units, I think that'll give us something to pay attention to as we begin looking at facilities.
But even as the density happens in the West, which it's not going to, but even the things I'm seeing, it's always where we can tie into town water somewhere, like, you know, Brookfield, Autumn Hill next to Percival or those things. So they're still going to be on utility, not without utility.
But again, even something like Brookfield, you know, they're going to probably come in ultimately and settle at a lower density. And if they came in at what they were approved with, from our perspective, that's not going to generate the need for additional school seats.
Agreed.
When you look at existing capacities, and that's how we would, you know, frame our
makes
reference
sense.
On that.
Right. So. Good. Okay. Any other questions for Sam? Sam, thank you. It's very, very enlightening. All right. Let's move on to the other side of this now. Jill, our demographer, is going to lead us through the differences between the census, the schools, the county, the fiscal impact committee, how about it?
And why Mrs. Brown?
Yes. here.
So the first thing we'll go through is the handout on the differences in the definitions and methods that are used for all the sources. So that'll give you background on why our numbers are different than Sam's and how they're different from the school census that we used to get. So the first thing is, we in 2009, for our capital intensity factors, we adopted as a committee the 2008 school census figures that were in that survey. And for the school census back then, those numbers that we approved, the SFD factors were by countywide, and they were by high school cluster, but they were not by the planning sub area or the rural versus suburban. So we didn't have that level of detail to go into for the single family detached that we're now doing on this committee. What was also different is that it was all children ages 5 to 19 and included the homeschooled, the private schools, and the public school students, whereas the numbers you just saw from Sam, as he mentioned, just include the public school students. So knowing that we included it like that before, we're doing a similar approach based on the available data for what I'm going to propose to you. And the housing stock included all households in the county, so it was households are the occupied housing units, whereas what Sam does, he includes every housing unit, whether it's vacant or occupied, so those give differences in the denominator for what we take students and divide by. So you certainly will get a lower number if you use all units, occupied and vacant.
It makes sense why Sam would count those, because when it's not vacant any longer, those are kids you got to plan to be in a school building that they have to account for.
Now, an unoccupied house, is that something under construction or just something somebody's moved out of and it's...
An occupied house actually has the student...
Unoccupied.
Unoccupied means, like, it could be a case where it's a turnover, where you're waiting for somebody to reoccupy it, wait for closing or something.
Right.
It can also be just some old house that has been vacated and unoccupied for a very long time, just abandoned.
Oh, okay.
So, and it could be renters. Again, a lot of it's turnover. It tends to be.
I can tell you when I knocked on doors campaigning, I knocked on about 12,000 doors. It took me months and months to do it. And I'd say probably one out of every 50 or 60 homes would be unoccupied. And it would have a for sale sign and a lockbox on it or a sold sign, but you go up and the house would be empty. No furniture, no nothing, 500 papers in the driveway, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a lot more than you think.
But that could change in a day, though, right?
Well, a lot of times somebody's bought the house, but, you know, they're not closing for 3 months or something. So it does, it could change, and then Sam, all of a sudden Sam's got kids in that house to put in a school somewhere.
But there's another house that empties out.
Yeah.
At some point, too, so the kind of balance as it goes along might not be the same house, but another one becomes vacant.
Yeah. Right, and that's where the vacancy rates come in that we, as a committee, went through last committee meeting, because that vacancy rate is fairly stable over time, as our data has shown,
right,
to your point.
Right.
So something also to take into account, the fact that it's stable.
Was that true during the foreclosure market a few years ago? Or do we even really know?
Vacancy rates.
We had a rash of foreclosures, if you remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're about out of it now, but you would think that would cause it to jump. It's not that important, but I'm just...
In 2010, especially on all our unit types, we had slightly higher in 2010 than what we are showing now in the region.
That makes sense. Okay.
So certainly that was the case.
Okay.
So that's the Virginia school census. And for the Loudoun County Public Schools, as you just saw, the utilities and the without utility areas are defined for SFD. which is different than what we do. Like we do something very similar so that we can try and mirror Sam's numbers and compare to those. And we do the rural versus the suburban. Now what's very different on the Loudoun County Public School side is the housing stock. What they use versus what we would propose that we use. For Loudoun County Public Schools, and Susan, definitely jump in if there's questions or you want to clarify something, but what Loudoun County Public Schools says they do is that the staff uses the county data from our land management information system, which is from the assessor's database, and our permitting system, things of that sort. They use that to identify all the residential housing units in the county. So those could be existing, they can be in the pipeline and under construction, but not yet done. So if they're not yet done, they don't have students in them yet, but they certainly will in the short term. And alternately, they do addresses that do not contain existing housing units and are not under construction but are counted as housing stock if they're not able to determine for certain that it is occupied or not. So you got some addresses in there certainly that probably aren't occupied yet that are in their numbers, which increases them. And these differences increase their housing unit count much above what we have approved as the committee and what we do when we base it on the census number plus any of the permits that have happened. So we get quite different numbers there. Ours, and again, in summary would mean that our housing unit count is several thousand below what Sam and them use. So that makes the difference in our numbers that you will be seeing. And then with the pupils, there's also a difference. And remember, the Virginia County School Census was all children ages 5 to 19, whereas what they do, they just do the public school students, and they could be age 5 or 19 but not be enrolled in the schools. Whereas those people not enrolled in schools that were age 5 or 19, the school census would have counted. Okay. So you got little things like that too going in there. And in addition, we've got pre-kindergarten students in Sam's numbers. And those are the pre-kindergarten students who are enrolled in the special education, but not those pre-kindergarten students that are in preschool. So only your special ed pre-kindergarten is what I've been told they include. So some differences in the ages and stuff going on there. So then the method that we are proposing now for the Fiscal Impact Committee is different than what we've done before, because remember, before we only had the school census and we didn't have the technology that we have now to analyze particularly new units, as you saw from Sam's presentation, new units can be much higher in their student generation than the older, matured homes. So what we propose is that we use the new unit information only to generate our student per pupil students per house, I should say, for the CIF factors. And by using the new units...
Now that skews it to the high end, correct?
Right, and that means you would be doing the worst case scenario, so when all those students are coming on in the short term, you will be able to have facilities for them at that point in time.
I'm glad Hobie's not here, because we'd have a very long discussion.
Yeah.
This is for you all to debate if you agree or disagree.
You also keep in mind that it gets back to new versus existing.
I'm sticking up for him, actually.
He'd agree with that.
He'd agree.
The CIF is used for new. So you want to be, that's another reason
why
we're. And again, I think as Sam pointed out when he showed your table about Brambleton, And one of the things that, that Susan has shared with us, I mean, when they were kind of looking at these communities, the first year that that school, I mean, that, that apartment might be occupied, or that complex might be occupied, very few students. But after, you know, a year, 2 years, or whatever, all of a sudden, you know, because of the methodology they're using, they're taking all, say, Diligent Leesburg was the one she used, you know, that's 330 units in there. Well, there are only 9 students that first year, because not all 333 of those units that they counted were occupied.
Right.
But now they're like 50 some odd. 38.
More than doubled, though.
It's more than doubled.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just that. And just as the units actually become occupied.
Online.
We're now starting to see that they are behaving like those
units.
So you're right, it is. I mean, Hobie would be having a pal here, but the reality is that we know, and certainly I think I've heard from other board members besides you, Mr. Buona, about we've got tons of kids coming into these new units.
Yep.
And yes, over time, we don't want to overbuild schools, but we certainly want new development to be addressing that larger segment, because those new units are the ones that are going to generate.
Yep.
Thank you. And also just the way the forecasts are done, when the next time, the 12th, you'll see population forecasts, for instance. So the reset year each time is the decennial census, 2010. And then you add population on top of that base until 2020. So what the committee's already seen in terms of household sizes and vacancy rates, those were based on an analysis that looked at what were the characteristics of new units between 2000 and 2010. So what is that demand in recent history? Who's going into those houses in terms of their household sizes recently? And the idea is then the new ones are going to be like the more recent units in the past.
Right, right. Makes sense. Jill?
Yeah, so let's see. Lastly, the pupils, with the data that we have available to us, could only use the children ages 5 to 18. So, like I said earlier, some of those may not be enrolled in schools, but it's our best available data. And for when it comes to doing the new units. So that includes the homeschool, private school, and the public school students, our numbers. And that is very similar to how the school census did it. So when we have an apples-to-apples comparison, using the school census is the best option, the past data, rather than comparing our numbers to public schools, since there's very different differences in the pupils and the housing units between the schools and our method and the school census. So again, compare ours to the school census for reasonability checks. So next page that we'll go over is our school age children per household, the 2010 census. So what you're seeing here, what we've first done as a reasonableness check against the school census, is that our total units for children age 5 to 18 in all units gives us a 0.68 children per household ratio. So that's the students per household. That's 0.68 for all units in the county, and this is coming from the census, the 2010 census, this figure. That compares extremely well to the 2008 school census, where they did all units, just like we're showing here. And again, they have it's a good apples to apples. And since our total units came up so similar to the 2008 numbers, that gives us comfort as staff in the numbers that we're generating for the new units versus the older units. And what we're seeing for the new units is that the student generation rate is higher. It's 0.74 overall, versus your all other units was 0.66.
So it's 10% different.
So that's all units in the county. Then, knowing that this generated similar stuff to 08, we can be comfortable in the breakdown by unit types that we've generated for the new units. That's what you're seeing here. For the multifamily, 0.24. The single family attached, 0.54. And then the SFD, 1.09 overall. But then we get the same trend that Sam was showing in the rural versus the suburban, without utilities. Lower in the rural areas and higher in the suburban.
And this is the first time we've broken stacked out separately, right?
Yes.
Interesting,
so
it's higher.
That.
Yeah, it is a little higher.
Yeah, it's not as wide a gap.
We expected that.
We expected that just as our household size analysis showed that we looked at last committee meeting.
Yep.
So same things we're seeing here as we saw with household sizes.
It's not a big difference.
And we use the same method that we used to generate the household sizes and vacancy rates that we looked at last time. Same method. So these are the numbers that we are recommending that the committee approve for the capital intensity factor process and for our guidelines. And before we do that, a good thing to look at it is our next handout that compares our 2009 guidelines, which again was the 2008 school census numbers, versus our newly proposed one, to see how different are they, and is everyone comfortable with the differences that, again, remembering what our purpose is for the capital facility needs.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that stands out the most is the single family detached.
Yes, quite different.
The other two are very, very similar, but there's a 0.87 in 2009, 1.09 in 2013. And if I go back to the school's number for single family detached, I got to look it up. It's, you know, it's a lot lower. It's, I got to find it. This handout didn't break it out that way.
0.77
is lower.
Well, the 0.77 is all housing units with utilities. Oh, no, there's single family detached, so it's 0.77 for utilities.
Again, over a broader base, that's why it's longer.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
No, but I just want to point out that the schools is lower than the 09. The 09 is quite a bit lower than the 2013. So the question becomes, what drove us up so much from 09? Because the percentage increases quite a bit, 20-some percent, 22% maybe.
I think it's reality what's driven it up. I mean, because it is reflecting the number of new units and the number of school children in those new units.
Well, the number of new units doesn't affect it. We're talking about the kids in the number of units.
But the number of new units are being generated in the suburban area.
Versus the old, right?
So that's the bigger number.
So you're seeing a mix change.
Well, if you look, the suburban's 1.1, and the overall number is 1.09. So what it's telling you is there's just not that many houses left.
Right.
So it's all being driven by the suburban.
Yep.
Right.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, that's for sure.
The other thing is, and Mr. Bowman, you probably recall this, I mean, the famous Goose Creek Preserve example is that now we're seeing it's in the multifamily, those units are generating more kids.
Right.
And so even the school's number shows that that's increasing. So it's not just us.
But those were multifamily. Those became single family attached.
Correct. But the stacked phenomenon was what
who would brought that. That's
issue.
That's right.
And now that we have that breakdown more accurately, we are seeing that
that number go up.
Yeah, what Julie's referring to is we had some development with townhomes off of Belmont Ridge Road, somewhat near Truro Parish, roughly, between there and Croson. And they looked like, they smelled like, they acted like single-family attached. They looked like townhomes. They acted like townhomes. But the floors of units overlap just a little bit, and one little piece of it, and the developer came in their application and said, no, these are multifamily units. I pay the much lower rate. We as a board said, well, let's get a zoning determination on this, and look, developer, if it comes back these are townhouses, you better belly up and pay for it, or we're not approving your application. The zoning determination was, from the zoning administrator, was these are townhomes, okay? And eventually the developer backed down and paid the full impact fee for townhomes. But that's what we see going on, because what they were claiming was, because of that little overlap, they were claiming they were multifamily stacked, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that was their way of trying to get around the higher impact fee.
But it's just highlighted for us that multifamily stacked really are generating
more kids. That's right.
And that's right. Partially because of the size of the units, number of bedrooms, a whole host of things, but that's being borne out in the actual numbers that the schools are creating. It's just that they're getting the right number of kids, they're having it over a larger denominator than we do.
Right.
And so our denominator is more closely aligned with the actual occupied units, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also the new units rather than
the whole county.
There's some differences in purpose in developing the data.
Right.
You're seeing that play.
And I know it was in a footnote, but how did you describe new?
The new units data shown correspond to the units within the census blocks that were used to develop the new unit vacancy rate and household sizes shown last
Okay, can we put that in English? How far back did we look to say something's new? Was it 2008, 2005, you know?
I was an expert.
Okay.
You beat me to it. If we did the new units from 2000 to 2010, but we didn't do all of them. We only did the ones where we could pretty much extract the census data from, because for the census geographies, we had to make sure that the unit type was homogeneous in that census geography.
Right.
So that cut down the number of new units we could actually use for analysis. But we still had a very large sample size.
But it's a good sample. Right.
Sample size was very large, even with some of the new units cut out, so it's still very reliable.
John?
I need help understanding. Pupil generation, rural, 0.98, suburban, 1.1. Pupils as a percent of household, they're both 29%. Shouldn't they be different?
The household sizes are different.
Yeah, one's 3.9 and one's 7.8.
Yeah.
Right.
So you multiply.
3.39 and 3.78.
Yeah.
The first problem.
Oh, so we have, all right, I got you. There's about 5/10 more non-pupils living in the single, all right. Those are the 26-year-olds that are staying on the insurance. I got it.
I love that Obamacare.
Yeah.
In the basement.
Not basement, garden.
Yeah, the garden apartment.
Yeah.
So what you see here in this table that's shown is the household sizes that were shown last time, and then you'll see that the pupil generation rates have pretty much the same trend, where like the stacked is higher than the attached, and the rural is less than the suburban. They should be the same trends because they came from the same database. And then the pupils as a percent of households, as you would expect, climbs for the as you get from the multifamily to the SFD, the larger houses generating more students. And then lastly, the last table we're showing there is the change in our pupil generation rates that we are proposing to use for this next CIF process. And the change is for the multifamily, the pupil generation rate has gone down very slightly, negative 0.02, and SFA has gone up 0.03, so those are very similar, knowing that we've had 4 years in between the times, we haven't had much change. But what has changed is the SFD, and that speaks to the fact that new units are really increasing in their student generations from your old, big difference from your older units, whereas MF and SFA didn't have much difference between the older and the new.
That really kind of makes sense, though. Like, multifamily, a lot of times it's not even families, it's singles living there or whatever. They're just not as big to accommodate children, you know, number of bedrooms, these kinds of things. So, I mean, it makes sense. But what's interesting is when you compare our numbers to the schools, even though we use different methodologies, their single family attached is 0.51, we're 0.54, their multifamily is 0.28, we're 0.24. So we're very close to each other. The only one that really deviates is the single family detached, and definitely it's because we're using the new. Well, I think it's very explainable.
It's also because they're using all students. We're using all students. You're using
yeah,
all students.
Yeah. We have different methodology, yeah. Right?
And home.
But we have different objectives.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out how to
pay
for schools, and
we're
trying to figure out how to pay for infrastructure.
But the differences are very explainable.
They're very explainable.
And the home
right.
school and private school and all that. Yeah.
That's,
I mean, not alone.
That's exactly right. Okay. Would anybody like to make an unofficial motion?
Yours, Fred.
Regarding pupil generation rates. The motion would be something to the effect that the Fiscal Impact Committee recommends, if you recommend, approval of the proposed 2013 guidelines presented in the staff analysis at the November 19, 2013 FIC Committee. It would be something to that effect.
I second
Fred's
motion.
The November 21st meeting.
All right. Well, you know what, I was reading up.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's up the November 19th handout, so you can see it either way.
My Roman numeral sundial watch doesn't work real well at night, but it works well enough that I remember from daytime hours that it's the 21st.
And now, if somebody doesn't agree with these, let's have that discussion first. To me, everything was very explainable where we saw the deviations.
It'd be real easy to draw a bridge chart.
Yeah, just one point. Remember, these are per household, so it does not include the vacant, which you brought up that point earlier.
Right.
Supervisor Bona with.
Right.
So are you comfortable with the fact that it's...
You know, that is an interesting question.
Knowing that we... are seeing that the vacant is stable over time.
Yeah, yes and no. And let me say the no part first. I'm not comfortable in the sense that I know those houses fill back up quickly, okay? I mean, the vast majority of them had under contract signs or sold signs on them, you know, those things. The other side of it is, though, that what we've seen in our vacancy rates on these things is that seems to go
Yeah, you sell one and another one goes on the market.
It's almost like unemployment.
It's a churn.
There's a level of what they call frictional unemployment that you always expect.
Well, there's a level of ins and outs. People transfer out, people transfer in.
It's an ongoing. The only spike we had was the foreclosure spike of around 2010. But other than that, I think it's pretty steady. So
yeah, or
I'm not sure it's bad.
If you get a major wave in.
And so our forecasting methods actually have separated out the vacancy rate. So when you forecast population, it's taking that household size and the vacancy rate
into account.
Right.
Right.
So this is keeping it parallel. And it's also how it's been done for the CIF in the past. It's just to use the household size and the pupil generation rate.
Gotcha.
Defined this way.
Right.
I second Fred's motion.
Fred, did you make
a
motion?
I don't think I actually made a motion. Right?
Fred,
you said
like
the motion was
did,
the regarding
remember.
The staff generate a student.
If I were to
generation
make a motion,
numbers.
I would move that the Fiscal Impact Committee approve the proposed 2013 guidelines prepared by staff in the report dated 19 November 2013 at the 21 November 2013 Fiscal Impact Committee meeting. If I were to make that motion.
Can I just ditto that?
Sounds like Fred to me. I second.
Yes.
I want to second.
All right, Fred, do you so move what I just said?
I so move.
Okay, is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, go for second it, John.
I'm going to get my name in the minutes so I know.
I want to give someone else a chance.
So when he turns in,
I'll tell you a little trick about that in a minute.
So when he turns in the snitch list to the supervisors, you're safe.
If you ever go, before we vote on this, but if you ever go read the minutes of Board of Supervisors business meetings, not our public hearings, it's going to look like I made 3/4 of the motions in every one of those meetings. It really does. Go read them. The reason is because a lot of our stuff is on what we call the consent agenda.
Yeah.
But each one of those has to be written up separately in the minutes. So I always move for approval of the consent agenda. And when I do that, now it looks in the minutes like I've made 400 motions during the meeting. Okay, when the reality is it was one motion. So there's your little trick. Okay, any discussion on the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes 6-0-7 with 7 absent.
Okay. What are we calling these kinds of motions again?
Straw votes.
But they can be verified if we have.
If in either of our next two meetings, if there is a 19 December meeting, which it doesn't look like we're going to need probably, but we'll cross that bridge after the next meeting on the 12th, right?
Right.
Correct.
If at the next meeting we have a quorum, we reaffirm all of these motions to get them official. If not, I will carry them to the full board as straw votes. I don't want to delay the process of getting this to the board.
Right.
Yeah,
do you need those motions written out as they were stated? How
well, the ones we made at the beginning on the 8 tables are written out already.
Right.
Yeah. So what we would, the only other motion we made is the one that just occurred, mm-hmm. and we are recording the meeting,
right.
So you could just transcribe what I say and put Fred's name next to it. And John did the second on it. So yeah, if we could write that one up, that way, if we have a quorum at the next one, we can hand that to everybody too.
Okay.
So let's just have all the motions again at the next meeting. That way we can make them officially if we need to.
And claim the try.
Yeah, and whoever makes them can just read them.
Yeah.
Right. So okay, what else? What are we doing at our next meeting?
So the next meeting we'll come back. You've provided your outlook for residential development, non-residential development. Now you have dealt with household size vacancy rate. We have the people generation factors as well. So all of that's going to be put into the book, like what Mr. Larkin has there. And what you will have seen, what you will see that you haven't seen before, is the resulting population, housing unit, and household forecasts, and the employment forecasts that result from it.
Okay, good. And as far as the capital intensity factor goes, where do we take that on in the process? I'm kind of playing straight man for you here.
Yeah, so that's in 2014. So we're trying to wrap up this book. What flows into the capital intensity factors from the work this year is the household size and the people generation rates.
Right.
Then next year, Mr. Sismar will be back before the committee leading you through the capital needs. And then that will be married up with capital costs and these rates to come up with draft capital intensity factors later in the year. Okay.
That'll be kind of fun going through the capital needs. I think everybody get to see, with all this population growth going on, the challenges that staff and the board face as far as infrastructure goes. Interesting. Will we be including roads in that anymore?
Well, yeah, I think,
you know, because it's the first CIP that is littered with roads, transportation projects. When we came into office, there were hardly any. Now, it's full of it, literally. And how do we account for that?
Yeah, I don't recall exactly what Mr. Mays said in terms of timing, but I think at our first meeting, the kickoff meeting for this time, he definitely addressed, hey, this is something the staff is well aware of and is working to figure out a proposal. I'm not sure what the plans are for the CIP.
Well, and the other half of that conversation, for the committee's sake, is, as you know, this deals with new, and a lot of the roadside of it, we try to extract as proffers outside of the capital intensity factor. And that's, in a perfect world, I'll assume there's no credits against this capital intensity factor. In a perfect world.
Right. We negotiate separate transportation
proffers.
However, as you know, there is a board resolution that allows for regional road improvements that go above and beyond what the applicant should be mitigate their impacts, that the board has the discretion to apply that to the capital intensity factor to give credit for it, basically.
Agreed.
I mean, but the irony in that one is, again, it's a little bit of robbing Peter to pay Paul because we don't have the other side of the ledger. That's what I told you in your first meeting. We don't calculate what that transportation thing is in the capital side of that formula. So giving credit to it just takes away from
the other needs.
The other needs.
Yeah.
But that's, again, proffers are voluntary. The process is negotiated. The number is the number. And you're drawing down from that number however you see fit.
Agreed.
I like that.
So it is an interesting
voluntary, but the number is the number.
Well, the number that you're using for your guideline is the number. That's
right.
That's your starting point, maybe. That
remember, they don't pay it. The home buyer pays it.
But I think the point is that from a capital needs assessment side, we account for everything from kennels to sheriff stations to you name it. We don't account for roads.
Well, not roads, but we do like park and
park and rides.
Park and rides. We also have bus shelters, transit centers. Yeah, there are
that's
capital
those are
facilities
in there.
That
right.
we do include
you're right.
as part of that number. But you're right, on the roads, no, we keep them in a separate bundle.
Well, and theoretically we should have, because they're Richmond's responsibility, supposedly.
Right.
But we're ended up building the dang things.
So. Well, and also we also use transportation proffers in non-residential rezonings too.
Correct.
So that's a completely
Look at cross trails.
So you have to have guidelines for both.
Right.
One thing, I did start circulating around the table the page from the beginning of the book that has everybody's name and
information.
So if you update that, I can get it into the draft of the 12th meeting, if any updates need.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Do we have any other business? All right. Did we stand adjourned?
Make a motion, will you adjourn?
So,
done.
See you in the minutes twice.
Hey, favor, aye.
That just shows I stayed for the whole thing.
You're adjourned. That's right.
That's right. Don't.